Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
My name is Lydia Via Komarov. That's Via as in Pancho, Komarov as in I married a Ukrainian. I am currently the founder and president of a one-person consulting firm, Intersection Science Business Diversity. I got interested in science very early. I was about 9. That's not usual, by the way. And most scientists that I know come to it a bit later. But I was a classic nerd when I was your age. So, and I like science fiction a lot. And I think that's what really attracted me. So I've been a scientist at the bench. I've been someone who helps run a university on the research side. I've been a businesswoman. I ran a company for a while. And now I am semi-retired, which means that I get to do what I want when I want to do it. The only problem is I do tend to overcommit, so I find myself quite busy.
Well, we thank you for joining us, even with all that busy schedule. That is, you know, a huge deal. So, I've studied quite a bit about some of your talks and your discussions, and so I, you know, took some notes here. So, you said once that instead of finding something new, find something that's important, and I thought that was such a cool quote. And could you maybe elaborate on that for some of the kids on here who would like to pursue a career in science?
Yes, it turns out that it's really easy to find a new discovery that nobody knows anything about, but it's not very interesting. It doesn't have an impact either on the science, certainly not right away, or on the general growth of knowledge. There's just so much we don't know. It's really easy to find out something new. You can go out in your backyard and find things that are not well known. So to be a successful scientist, it really is if you can find a problem which is one interesting, that is to say it's interesting in that it will either advance a particular field of study or it solves a problem that is in the society at the moment, that is a good thing. The other thing you have to do is be sure that that question, that problem, is solvable or at least approachable with the technology that's available in the moment. You can pick a really interesting problem. They're sort of easy, like development. How do you get from an egg to an adult? That question in and of itself contains so many other questions that you have to bring it down to what you can do in the moment. And the exciting thing for you guys is that science, all fields really, but science in particular is constantly being able to dig deeper and wider because of new technology that gets developed. For example, the Webb telescope has opened up lots of things in astronomy, in biology, which is my field, molecular biology. We now can pretty easily manipulate DNA and RNA and do sequencing so that you can do large numbers of sequences in a very short time and pull the information out of that. The computer science has come into everything, so we can handle big amounts of data that our brains really aren't very good at handling. It's only going to get more interesting, so enjoy the ride.
That is a wonderful quote, enjoy the ride. One of the students had emailed us, what drew you to molecular biology when you were younger?
Well, it was partly that was the question that I thought was most fascinating, was the developmental biology one. When you think about it, you go from two gametes, a sperm and an egg, that get together, and then something happens, and that single cell starts dividing to make many cells. And then those many cells seem to know what to do to generate specific organs. They know where to go. And so all of that was, how does that happen? That struck me as one of the most interesting problems there was. And it seemed to me that the molecular biologists were the ones who were developing the appropriate tools. Now, it turned out that when I went to graduate school, which is where you learn how to be a scientist, there wasn't anybody there who was doing developmental biology in a way that appealed to me. So I went into viruses instead because they made a really good model system for figuring out how molecules, living creatures reproduce themselves, how they get into cells, how cells interact. So I did virus work for my PhD thesis. And then I went to a lab where I thought I would do developmental biology using the silk moth, the wild silk moth, as a model. And that turned out to be too complicated. The silk moth turns out is as complicated as a human being in terms of the size of its genome. And given the tools that we had then, I couldn't really make much progress with the silk moth. And that's when I turned to what molecular biologists back in the 70s, when I was at that stage, was doing, was really focusing on individual molecules. And that's how I got into a project that asked the question, could we make insulin outside of the pancreas? Could we make it in a bacterial cell or a yeast cell? And that turned out to be a very productive thing. People had been working on it. I joined the project. 6 months later, we wrote a paper. And that work really set the tone for my entire career. It opened doors enormously.
That is, yeah, and it was groundbreaking. You know, obviously, absolutely massive. One of our students wanted to know, when you were working and coming up in graduate school and for your PhD, was there a lot of math that you used in your field?
Oh, that's very funny. Actually, when I was applying to graduate school, I did not apply to MIT. And the reason I didn't apply initially is because I am not very math ept. I just didn't get it. And I think probably it didn't help that I didn't have the best instruction, but nevertheless, you know, even in college, I didn't do so well in things that required a lot of math. So I said, I can't go to MIT because I can't do math. And a very wise person whose lab I was working in for the summer, she was going to write my letters of recommendation, which are an important part of that application. And she said, where's MIT? I had applied to every school in the Boston area, Harvard, BU, Tufts, Brandeis, two programs at Harvard, actually, one at the medical school, one at the main campus. But I had not applied to MIT. So she said, you have to apply to MIT because they have the best molecular biology department in the country and probably in the world. So if you're really serious about molecular biology, you have to at least apply. And so reluctantly I did because I respected her a lot. And it was a good thing because MIT was the only school that accepted me in Boston. So it turned out that there were some things in graduate school where I had to use math. And I fortunately, one of my classmates had been a physics major in college. So he helped me with the physics and the math, and I helped him with the biology. And we both did it, got through. So, you know, a weakness only means that you may have to work harder in that area than somebody else. It shouldn't be a reason for not doing something that you otherwise really like. And in fact, after that, I use very little math. One of the things that I regret is that I never learned statistics really at any level. And that's a problem now because once you start working with big data, you really do need to know about statistics, or if you're in clinical trials or any of that. So I had to do it the hard way, which was on my own. And it's not something that I'm comfortable with. I always have to find somebody who's really good at it so that we can collaborate.
I bet. And I bet that you keep some pretty brilliant company, I'm guessing, going to the schools that you went to. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, one of the kids wanted to know, can you talk to us a little bit about the mentors that you had growing up? Before, during, and during your career?
Well, before my career, I have a really big family. I'm the eldest of six kids. My father has 14 brothers and sisters that grew up to adulthood. My mom's family is kind of small. She has two siblings. So I have over 100 first cousins when you put them all together. I have 17 nieces and nephews and 31 grandniblings. So it's a big family. And of course, that means that as a child, a lot of what was going on revolved around family. So family were really my first role models. And among them were my parents. They were each the first in their family to go to college. They were unusual in many respects. Mom worked all the time. I mean, she was a career woman. My father was a teacher, and he was the one who'd come home and fix dinner because mom didn't get home till 5 or 6 and dad got home about 3:34. So he would do the cooking. He wouldn't wash dishes though. He said that was our job. As soon as we could reach the sink, we did the dishes. And before that time, he just left them in the sink. So they were, and my grandmother was a woman who was a single mom. She raised her 3 children on her own. She threw out her husband because he was a drunk. And her father sent her and her sisters to what would be called to get schooling beyond high school so they could be teachers. And the reason he did that was because he did not want his daughters to marry cowboys. His sons left school in grade school once they knew how to read and once they had a basic understanding of arithmetic, because they had to know enough about arithmetic to be able to add and subtract so they didn't get cheated, and they had to be able to read contracts. So my grandfather was, my great-grandfather rather, was a key figure in the family on my mother's side. And I had an uncle who was a master's degree in chemistry. So he was someone who told me it was easier to write a science paper than an English essay. That impressed me. So those were most of my mentors during childhood. In school, I was also lucky. We had a principal who gave us awards when we got a school letter if we made the honor roll and the honor society. So the letter was just like the athletic letter, except it had the little lamp of learning on it. And I had a teacher who was an English teacher who, first of all, had a lot to do with teaching me how to write. And secondly, when she found out I was going to college and didn't have much money, she got a rich friend of hers to write me a check for $300, which got me there and was a very important vote of confidence in an important time. In college and graduate school, the mentors became more important because these were people who were teaching me how to be scientists, who were allowing me to grow in ways that said that, yeah, this might be hard, but you know, you can do it. If it's something that you should try because you could be good at it. And in graduate school, that was key. You know, there was Loretta Levy she was someone I worked for at NIH when I was an undergraduate. She's the one who made me apply to MIT. Teachers in college are really important. I went to a small college. For me, that was the right thing to do. But even in a big college, you will find that there are faculty and teaching assistants who they're there to help you. So you really have to reach out to them when you need help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, these kids, I'm sure you guys are going to find in your journey, there's going to be mentors like the ones that Lydia is talking about.
And they'll be different. You'll have different ones at different times.
Yeah. We have Christina in Italy. You can unmute. She had a really good question you should be able to ask.
I wanted to ask you, how was your experience at Harvard Med, and if you found that it was a very amazing experience?
Oh, it is. I mean, the thing about an institution like MIT or Harvard is that there are lots of talented people around. And so it's easy to find interesting people or people who know more who can help you out with a particular problem. It was quite wonderful. Often when students ask me if they should go to MIT as undergraduates, I will say, I would recommend going to Harvard as an undergraduate, MIT for graduate school. MIT is really graduate school focused. The number of graduate students outnumbers the number of undergraduates. if you are someone who thrives in a very competitive environment, under a lot of pressure, then MIT can be wonderful. And there are some remarkable people that undergraduates who are there. So it really depends on you. You have to pick the environment that is going to be the environment that pulls out all of your talents. And that differs. It's not, Harvard and MIT aren't the right place for everybody. But when you find the right place, it's magic.
That's a wonderful quote. We have a question from Ludmilla. We'll do a few more questions before we let Lydia go. Ludmilla, you should be able to unmute to ask your question.
Hello. I was wondering if you worked on any science project before going to college?
Well, I sort of did them on my own. The best Christmas present I ever got was a chemistry set. And I played around with mixing things up separate from the way they said to in that. I dissected frogs as a kid just because. The very first experiment I did was my little brother and I went around the house and shot water from our squirt guns on every light bulb in the house. The lit ones broke and the ones that weren't lit didn't break. That was my first finding. But I did no formal things as in high school. Well, that's not quite true. Actually, there was a program called the National Science Foundation Summer Science Training Program. It doesn't exist anymore. And so as a junior in high school, I went to a college in Texas and spent the summer doing experiments there, looking at adrenal glands in rats. And that was a very nice experience. Now it's not easy, but it's easier for students, high school students, to find opportunities to do research.
Sure. And they can search online and find all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah. There's
endless amounts of resources. This question is from Noha. Noha, you can unmute to ask.
Hello. My question is, are you satisfied with your work, with your job, or you seem like you could do more?
Well, you know, that's the thing about when I was in school, in college, I wanted to be a scientist. And so I went to graduate school to learn how to be a scientist. And once I got there, I realized that I didn't just want to be a scientist. I wanted to run my own laboratory and ask interesting questions. As a postdoc, I learned that I wanted to do that in an academic setting, not in a company. I was offered a job in the biotech industry, was brand new then. And so I was offered a job in a new company that one of my mentors had started. That was Biogen, for those of you who might know it. And I decided, no, I really wanted to run my own lab and see what I could do on my own. And so I did that. So as you advance, your sense of what's enough changes. The other thing I had to learn was how to say that you cannot do everything all the time. There's so many things that are interesting to do or good to do or satisfying to do. And if you try to do all of them, then there's a good chance you won't do any one of them well. So you have to learn where the limits of your own energy and things are, how much time you need for yourself to recharge and all that, and do that accordingly. So I think in the end, there's always times when I feel that you know, I could have done more with this, or I should have done that earlier, or I could have done that better. But in the end, if you're doing the best that you can most of the time, and you are you learn how to discipline yourself to not try to do too much at once, then you'll be fine.
Absolutely. We have one final question, and this is comes from Maria Shara, and apologies if I'm mispronouncing that, but go ahead and ask your question.
Have some people been prejudiced about you as a woman?
Yes. I mean, you know, I'm a Mexican-American woman, second generation, but nevertheless. And it's still true in our society. There are biases against women and there are biases against people of color in our country and really across the world. So there have been times, fortunately for me, I am dense. I don't notice a lot of things like that, or I'll realize it sometime later. So that when I was an undergraduate, I started out as a chemistry major, and I was having real trouble. I was not having a good time, and I wasn't doing very well. So I went to go see my chem advisor, and he said, well, of course you're having trouble in chemistry. Women don't belong in chemistry. And so I said, oh, okay, and changed my major, actually several times before I settled back on biology. So two things. There are people in the world who may not even know that they have these prejudices, these biases against people of color or women, because there's a whole thing now about how our mind works that tells us this. Not all prejudice is meant. And to be biased does not mean to be prejudiced. To be prejudiced means you mean it. You don't like certain people and you know it. To be biased means that you may think that everybody should have an equal chance, but if you look at your actions, that's not actually the case. And you do that without even thinking about it, it turns out. So one of the things you need to learn to do is to recognize those people. And I had a radar that there were people I didn't feel comfortable talking to. And I think it's because they weren't really listening to me. And so if you can avoid those kind of people, then you'll be fine no matter what.
Thank you so much for that, that wisdom. I know we have a lot of young women on here as well as men. And, there's nothing you guys can't do. And I'm so happy that we were able to connect you with Dr. Via Camarena. Do you speak any Ukrainian or Russian?
No, neither does my husband. His grandparents both sides came from Russia and Ukraine, but he doesn't speak any Ukrainian or Russian.
All right.
And so there was no one to learn from.
All good. So before we let you go, I ask this of all of our guests. As someone who's so accomplished as yourself, you've done so much in your career, both with science and business, as well as your philanthropic work, giving back to multiple communities, not just your own. What kind of advice would you have for these students as they go off into the world and figure out what kind of path they want to lead?
The main thing is to know yourself. To know what you want to do and where you want to put your energies that you think will make you feel satisfied. And the second thing is to not, pardon me, the second thing is not to try to do everything at once. You can have everything you want, but not necessarily at the same time. So you have to set priorities. When there are times when you'll be doing this, like going to college, for example, and you maybe want to do something in the community, that's fine, but grades come first when you're an undergraduate, because it makes it so much easier to get into a good graduate school. And then if you're a faculty member or you're doing a job, you have to learn the difference between what you need to do to get it promoted so that you can get into a position where you can actually make decisions for that organization, and the stuff that has to be done, but it doesn't all have to be done by you. So learning how to say no is really important.
That's really great advice. And guys, I put in the chat, we have a lot of amazing upcoming guest speakers like Lydia. Go ahead and sign up for however many you'd like. And Lydia, before we let you go, before I end the meeting for all, I am going to allow all the students to unmute. And can we all say thank you to Lydia for taking time out of her valuable day to talk to you guys today? Thank you, Lydia, so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.